Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Ameripox edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week's web wisdom, Ameripox, domesticated animals, replicating science, and much, much more. Let's begin episode 348.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Many of us know that most of the First Nations people died off due to disease brought here from Europe. But why didn't the Europeans die from diseases that were brought back? Let's listen to CGP Grey and find out why.
Between the first Europeans arriving in 1492 and the Victorian age, the indigenous population of the New World dropped by at least 90%. The cause? Not the conquistadors and company. They killed lots of people, but their death count is nothing compared to what they brought with them. Smallpox, typhus, tuberculosis, influenza, bubonic plague, cholera, mumps, measles, and more leapt from those first explorers to the coastal tribes, then onward the microscopic invaders spread through a hemisphere of people with no defenses against them. Tens of millions died. These germs decided the fate of these battles long before the fighting started. Now ask yourself, why didn't the Europeans get sick? If New Worlders were vulnerable to Old World diseases, then surely Old Worlders would be vulnerable to New World diseases. Yet there was no Ameripox spreading eastward, infecting Europe, and cutting the population from 90 million to 9. Had Ameripox existed, it would have rather dampened European ability for transatlantic expansion. To answer why this didn't happen, we need first to distinguish regular diseases like the common cold from what we'll call plagues. First, plagues spread quickly between people. Sneezes spread plagues faster than handshakes, which are faster than closeness. Plagues use more of this than this. Secondly, and importantly, they kill you quickly or you become immune. Catch a plague and you're dead within 7 to 30 days. Survive and you'll never get it again. Your body has learned to fight it. You might still carry it. The plague lives in you. You can spread it, but it can't hurt you. The surface answer to this question isn't that Europeans had better immune systems to fight off New World plagues. It's that the New World didn't have plagues for them to catch. They had regular diseases, but there was no Ameripox to carry. These are history's biggest killers, and they all come from the Old World. But why? Let's dig deeper and talk cholera. A plague that spreads if your civilization does a bad job of separating drinking water from pooping water. London was terrible at this, making it the cholera capital of the world. Cholera can rip through dense neighborhoods, killing swaths of the population before moving onward. But that's the key. It has to move on. In a small, isolated group, a plague like cholera cannot survive. It kills all available victims, leaving only the immune, and then there's nowhere to go. It's a fire that burns through its fuel. but a city, shining city on the hill, to which rural migrants flock, where hundreds of babies are born a day. This is sanctuary for the fire of plague. Fresh kindling comes to it. The plague flares and smolders and flares and smolders again, impossible to extinguish. Historically, in city borders, plagues killed faster than people could breed. Cities grew because more people moved to them than died inside of them. Cities only started growing from their own population in the 1900s, when medicine finally left its leeches and bloodletting phase and entered its soap and soup phase, giving humans some tools to slow death. But before that, a city was an unintentional playground for plagues and a grim machine to sort the immune from the rest. So the deeper answer is that the New World didn't have plagues because the New World didn't have big, dense, terribly sanitized, deeply interconnected cities for plagues to thrive. Okay, but the New World wasn't completely barren of cities, and tribes weren't completely isolated. Otherwise, the newly arrived smallpox in the 1400s couldn't have spread. Cities are only part of the puzzle. They're required for plagues, but cities don't make the germs that start the plagues. Those germs come from the missing piece. Now, most germs don't want to kill you for the same reason you don't want to burn down your house. Germs live in you. Chronic diseases like leprosy are terrible because they're very good at living in you and not killing you. Plague lethality is an accident, a misunderstanding, because the germs that cause plagues don't know they're in humans. They think they're in this. Plagues come from animals. Whooping cough comes from pigs, as does flu, as well as from birds. Our friend the cow alone is responsible for measles, tuberculosis, and smallpox. For the cow, these diseases are no big deal, like colds for us. But when cow germs get in humans, the things they do to make a cow a little sick to spread make humans very sick, deadly sick. Now, germs jumping species is extraordinarily rare. That's why generations of humans can spend time around animals just fine. Being the patient zero of a new animal-to-human plague is winning a terrible lottery. But a colonial-age city raises the odds. There used to be animals everywhere. Horses, herds of livestock in the streets, open slaughterhouses, meat markets pre-refrigeration, and rivers of human and animal excrement running through it all. A more perfect environment for diseases to jump species could hardly be imagined. So the deeper answer is that plagues come from animals, but so rarely that you have to raise the odds with many chances for infection. And even then, the newborn plague needs a fertile environment to grow. The old world had the necessary pieces in abundance. But why was a city like London filled with sheep and pigs and cows and Tenochtitlan wasn't? This brings us to the final level, for this video anyway. Some animals can be put to human use. This is what domestication means. Animals you can breed, not just hunt. Forget for a moment the modern world. Go back to 10,000 BC, when tribes of humans reached just about everywhere. If you were in one of these tribes, what local animals could you capture alive and successfully pen to breed? Maybe you're in North Dakota and thinking about catching a buffalo, an unpredictable, violent tank on hooves that can outrun you across the plains, leap over your head, and travels in herds thousands strong. Oh, and you have no horses to help you because there are no horses on the continent. Horses live here and won't be brought over until too late. It's just you, a couple buddies, and stone-based tools. American Indians didn't fail to domesticate buffalo because they couldn't figure it out. They failed because it's a buffalo. No one could do it. Buffalo would have been amazing creatures to put to human work back in BC, but it's not going to happen. Humans have only barely domesticated buffalo with all of our modern tools. The New World didn't have good animal candidates for domestication. Almost everything big enough to be useful is also too dangerous or too agile. Meanwhile, the Fertile Crescent to Central Europe had cows and pigs and sheep and goats. Easy peasy animals comparatively begging to be domesticated. A wild boar is something to contend with if you have only stone tools, but it's possible to catch and pen and breed and feed to eat, because pigs can't leap to the sky or crush all resistance beneath their hooves. In the New World, the only native domestication contestant was llamas. They're better than nothing, which is probably why the biggest cities existed in South America, but they're no cow. Ever tried to manage a herd of llamas in the mountains of Peru? Yeah, you can do it, but it's not fun. Nothing but drama, these llamas. These might seem cherry-picked examples, because aren't there hundreds of thousands of species of animals? Yes, but when you're stuck at the bottom of the tech tree, almost none of them can be domesticated. From the dawn of man until this fateful meeting, humans domesticated maybe a baker's dozen of unique species the world over. And even to get to that high a number, you need to stretch it to include honeybees and silkworms. Nice to have, but you can't build a civilization on a foundation of honey alone. These early tribes weren't smarter or better at domestication. The old world had more valuable and easy animals. With dogs, herding sheep and cattle is easier. Now humans have a buddy to keep an eye on the clothing factory and the milk and cheeseburger machine and the plow puller. Now farming is easier, which means there's more benefit to staying put, which means more domestication, which means more food, which means more people and more density. And oh, look where we're going. Citiesville. Population lots. Bring your animals, plagues welcome. That is the full answer. The lack of New World animals to domesticate limited not only exposure to germ sources, but also limited food production, which limited population growth, which limited cities, which made plagues in the New World an almost impossibility. In the Old, exactly the reverse, and thus a continent full of plague and a continent devoid of it. So when ships landed in the New World, there was no America pox to bring back. The game of civilization has nothing to do with the players and everything to do with the map. Access to domesticated animals in numbers and diversity is the key resource to bootstrapping a complex society from nothing. And that complexity brings with it, unintentionally, a passive biological weaponry devastating to outsiders. Start the game again, but move the domesticatable animals across the sea, and history's arrow of disease and death flows in the opposite direction. This still does leave one last question. Just why are some animals domesticatable and others not? Why couldn't American Indians domesticate deer? Why can't zebras be domesticated? They look just like horses. And what does it mean to tame an animal? To answer that, part two.
And let's take a moment and think about how geography affects history as we take this little break.
An enabled FM chip in your smartphone can make the difference in an emergency situation by allowing you to still hear critical updates. It will also let you listen to the local FM station using 3 times less battery and 20 times less data than streaming. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, your plague-free skeptical radio broadcast. And we're back. Now let's follow up Ameripox with part two. Why can you domesticate some animals and not others? Let's find out now.
Sheep weren't always this fluffy. We fluffified them by breeding the fluffiest in each generation. This is domestication, sculpting wild animals for better human use. As we saw in part one, for early man, animals were powerful tools. Food, clothing, transportation, tractors. Yet though there were animals everywhere, only a handful were domesticated in the pre-modern world. What made these different? Let's make a domestication checklist, shall we? First up, feedable. A cow is a machine that turns grass into steaks, and a tiger a machine that turns steaks into tiger. 10 pounds of grass make a pound of steak, and 10 pounds of steak make a pound of tiger. But these have the same number of calories, so you might as well just eat the cow and save yourself a lot of work. So pure carnivores, you're not going to domesticate just because of thermodynamics. You're looking for herbivores that aren't picky. They should eat something that's everywhere that you can't eat. Any omnivores better be happy eating whatever and better be super worth it. We are, however, putting the pig before the pen here because first we need to catch something that's friendly. Okay, obviously catching a carnivore is a bad idea anyway because their day job is murder, but plenty of omnivores like grizzlies moonlight in murder. No safety in vegetarians either. Buffalo are terrifying tanks for all the reasons mentioned before. Hippos hold the murder high score in Africa. Giraffes look real dorky until you consider their striking range. Lions mostly leave them alone. Animals it would be awesome to domesticate are not coincidentally super dangerous. War bears would be a hell of an advantage for your tribe, but it's not going to happen. And if it's big and not dangerous, it's a nervous wreck. Try sneaking up on a gazelle? Rhymes with LOL. Sure, you and a team of buddies could spend the whole day marathon jogging it down to exhaustion, but if it doesn't break its own neck as you try to drag it back home, then it's going to casually leap out of whatever pen you built for it. Okay, next up. Some animals have reproductive, preferences that make them incompatible with captivity. Looking at you, pandas. The time and energy humans have spent to get pandas to get on with it is comical. Hunter-gatherers need an animal so eager to breed it gets it wrong sometimes, not an animal whose mating seasons they have to keep careful track of. So friendly, feedable, and fecund, it also needs to grow up fast. This gets us to the heart of domestication versus taming. Again, to domesticate a species is to change it to make it better for us. And side note here, we domesticate plants as well. We've bred them to be monstrous versions of their wild selves. So when hippies talk about going back to nature, they forget that these plants are just as man-made as this Pop-Tart. Anyway, back to the animals. The pig porkification project succeeded because pig generations are shorter than human generations. A single clever human can make porky progress in their lifetime. Compare and contrast elephants. 2 years to make a calf, 5 years in between calves, 9 years until female maturity, 15 years for males? You've got to be kidding, elephants. There's no time for this. But humans can still tame elephants. You can catch an elephant and train it not to freak out around humans, then put it to work. But elephant domestication would require accurate records over several human lives. Never mind that keeping one or two tamed elephants around is incredibly costly, which is why war elephants only happened on occasion in already complex societies. Tame elephants are a luxury, hence this rule of thumb. If it's on a farm, it's domesticated. If it's in a circus, it's tame. Finally, families. Okay, zebra versus horses. Horses are civilization game changers. It's remarkable to think that from thousands BC until the telegraph, a dude on a horse was the best internet available. Horses were domesticated in Eurasia, but humans started in Africa, which has zebra. Why didn't the first humans ride out of Africa on the backs of zebra to conquer the world? Because zebra are bastards. They live to kick and bite, dangerous in a pre-penicillin world, and zebra also have a ducking reflex, making them very frustrating to lasso. In addition to being a real pain in the ass animal, zebra lack a family structure. Horse herds hierarchy. You can see it when they travel in a line. The male, top female, her foals, second female, her foals, and so on. Humans, by capturing and taming the lead male, become head horse. Lots of barnyard animals are barnyard animals because they have family values humans exploit. They just grow up with the idea that this human is a funny sort of take charge cow or whatever. No big deal. Chickens will peck, peck, peck until they've worked out who's top chicken. But you know who's really top chicken? We're top chicken. Dogs and cats, this is what makes them different. Dogs will love you and defend you and hunt with you because you're part of the pack. Dogs live to be useful to us, which in the modern world means falling over to play dead, but they love it.
Bang. Good girl, good girl.
Whereas a cat is a tiny tiger that lives in your house. Okay, back to these guys. For zebra, there's no such thing as society. They hang out in groups because it's a good survival strategy, but they don't really care. Catch a zebra and his family won't follow. Try to ride him and you'll be lucky to keep your fingers. Zebra look like horses on the outside, but not on the inside. So that's the checklist. Friendly, feedable, fecund, family-friendly. It's not a long checklist, but for hunter-gatherers, any animal they wanted to domesticate needed everything, which is why in early human history, only a baker's dozen of big animals were domesticated the world over.
And in an effort to domesticate our dear listeners, we'll allow you to take a break now.
Thousands of opinions are at our fingertips, but are all opinions informed? Does your information have a source? Is your social feed based on fact? Only facts can uncover the truth. Professional journalists are committed to balanced and nonpartisan reporting, to independent commentary. They cut through the spin to give you the information and perspective you need. Journalism is essential to democracy. A watchdog over the powerful, an independent voice. Journalism is more important than ever.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, where science and reason has been domesticated for your listening pleasure. And we're back. We all trust science, but nothing should be a sacred cow, dogmatic. Let's listen in on how science can be manipulated and how science's built-in mechanisms help correct for these kind of errors.
In 2011, an article was published in the reputable Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. It was called Feeling the Future: Experimental Evidence for Anomalous Retroactive Influences on Cognition and Affect. Or in other words, proof that people can see into the future. The paper reported on 9 experiments. In one, participants were shown 2 curtains on a computer screen and asked to predict which one had an image behind it. The other just covered a blank wall. Once the participant made their selection, the computer randomly positioned an image behind one of the curtains. Then the selected curtain was pulled back to show either the image or the blank wall. The images were randomly selected from one of 3 categories: neutral, negative, or erotic. If participants selected the curtain covering the image, this was considered a hit. Now, with there being 2 curtains and the images positioned randomly behind one of them, you would expect the hit rate to be about 50%. And that is exactly what the researchers found, at least for negative and neutral images. However, for erotic images, the hit rate was 53%. Does that mean that we can see into the future? Is that slight deviation significant? Well, to assess significance, scientists usually turn to p-values, a statistic that tells you how likely a result, at least this extreme, is if the null hypothesis is true. In this case, the null hypothesis would just be that people couldn't actually see into the future and the 53% result was due to lucky guesses. For this study, the p-value was 0.01, meaning there was just a 1% chance of getting a hit rate of 53% or higher from simple luck. P-values less than 0.05 are generally considered significant and worthy of publication. But you might want to use a higher bar before you accept that humans can accurately perceive the future and, say, invite the study's author on your news program. But hey, it's your choice. After all, the 0.05 threshold was arbitrarily selected by Ronald Fisher in a book he published in 1925. But this raises the question: how much of the published research literature is actually false? The intuitive answer seems to be 5%. I mean, if everyone's using p less than 0.05 as a cutoff for statistical significance, you would expect 5 of every 100 results to be false positives. But that, unfortunately, grossly underestimates the problem. And here's why. Imagine you're a researcher in a field where there are 1,000 hypotheses currently being investigated. Let's assume that 10% of them reflect true relationships and the rest are false. But no one, of course, knows which are which. That's the whole point of doing the research. Now, assuming the experiments are pretty well designed, they should correctly identify around, say, 80 of the 100 true relationships. This is known as a statistical power of 80%. So 20 results are false negatives. Perhaps the sample size was too small or the measurements were not sensitive enough. Now consider that from those 900 false hypotheses using a p-value of 0.05, 45 false hypotheses will be incorrectly considered true. As for the rest, they will be correctly identified as false, but most journals rarely publish null results. They make up just 10 to 30% of papers, depending on the field. Which means that the papers that eventually get published will include 80 true positive results, 45 false positive results, and maybe 20 true negative results. Nearly a third of published results will be wrong, even with the system working normally. Things get even worse if studies are underpowered, and analysis shows they typically are, if there is a higher ratio of false to true hypotheses being tested, or if the researchers are biased. All of this was pointed out in a 2005 paper entitled Why Most Published Research is False. So recently, researchers in a number of fields have attempted to quantify the problem by replicating some prominent past results. The Reproducibility Project repeated 100 psychology studies, but found only 36% had a statistically significant result the second time around. And the strength of measured relationships were on average half those of the original studies. An attempted verification of 53 studies considered landmarks in the basic science of cancer only managed to reproduce 6. Even working closely with the original study's authors. These results are even worse than I just calculated. The reason for this is nicely illustrated by a 2015 study showing that eating a bar of chocolate every day can help you lose weight faster. In this case, the participants were randomly allocated to one of 3 treatment groups. One went on a low-carb diet, another went on the same low-carb diet plus a 1.5-ounce bar of chocolate per day, and the third group was the control, instructed just to maintain their regular eating habits. At the end of 3 weeks, the control group had neither lost nor gained weight, but both low-carb groups had lost an average of 5 pounds per person. The group that ate chocolate, however, lost weight 10% faster than the non-chocolate eaters. The finding was statistically significant with a p-value less than 0.05. As you might expect, this news spread like wildfire to the front page of Bild, the most widely circulated daily newspaper in Europe, and then to the Daily Star, the Irish Examiner, the Huffington Post, and even Shape magazine. Unfortunately, the whole thing had been faked. Kind of. I mean, researchers did perform the experiment exactly as they described, but they intentionally designed it to increase the likelihood of false positives. The sample size was incredibly small, just 5 people per treatment group, and for each person, 18 different measurements were tracked, including weight, cholesterol, sodium, blood protein levels, sleep quality, well-being, and so on. So if weight loss didn't show a significant difference, there were plenty of other factors that might have. So the headline could have been chocolate lowers cholesterol, or increases sleep quality, or something. The point is, a p-value is only really valid for a single measure. Once you're comparing a whole slew of variables, the probability that at least one of them gives you a false positive goes way up. And this is known as p-hacking. Researchers can make a lot of decisions about their analysis that can decrease the p-value. For example, let's say you analyze your data and you find it nearly reaches statistical significance. So you decide to collect just a few more data points to be sure. Then, if the p-value drops below 0.05, you stop collecting data, confident that these additional data points could only have made the result more significant if there were really a true relationship there. But numerical simulations show that relationships can cross the significance threshold by adding more data points, even though a much larger sample would show that there really is no relationship. In fact, there are a great number of ways to increase the likelihood of significant results, like having 2 dependent variables, adding more observations, controlling for gender, or dropping 1 of 3 conditions. Combining all 3 of these strategies together increases the likelihood of a false positive to over 60%, and that is using p less than 0.05. Now, if you think this is just a problem for psychology, neuroscience, or medicine, consider the pentaquark, an exotic particle made up of 5 quarks, as opposed to the regular 3 for protons or neutrons. Particle physics employs particularly stringent requirements for statistical significance, referred to as 5 sigma, or 1 chance in 3.5 million of getting a false positive. But in 2002, a Japanese experiment found evidence for the theta plus pentaquark, and in the 2 years that followed, 11 other independent experiments then looked for and found evidence of that same pentaquark with very high levels of statistical significance. From July 2003 to May 2004, a theoretical paper on pentaquarks was published on average every other day. But alas, it was a false discovery. Further experimental attempts to confirm the theta plus pentaquark using greater statistical power failed to find any trace of its existence. The problem was, those first scientists weren't blind to the data. They knew how the numbers were generated and what answer they expected to get. And the way the data was cut and analyzed, or p-hacked, produced the false finding. Now, most scientists aren't p-hacking maliciously. There are legitimate decisions to be made about how to collect, analyze, and report data, and these decisions impact on the statistical significance of results. For example, 29 different research groups were given the same data and asked to determine if dark-skinned soccer players are more likely to be given red cards. Using identical data, some groups found there was no significant effect, while others concluded dark-skinned players were 3 times as likely to receive a red card. The point is that data doesn't speak for itself. It must be interpreted. Looking at those results, it seems that dark-skinned players are more likely to get red-carded, but certainly not three times as likely. Consensus helps in this case, but for most results, only one research group provides the analysis, and therein lies the problem of incentives. Scientists have huge incentives to publish papers. In fact, their careers depend on it. As one scientist, Brian Nosek, puts it, there is no cost to getting things wrong. The cost is not getting them published. Journals are far more likely to publish results that reach statistical significance. So if a method of data analysis results in a p-value less than 0.05, then you're likely to go with that method. Publication's also more likely if the result is novel and unexpected. This encourages researchers to investigate more and more unlikely hypotheses, which further decreases the ratio of true to spurious relationships that are tested. Now, what about replication? Isn't science meant to self-correct by having other scientists replicate the findings of an initial discovery? In theory, yes, but in practice, it's more complicated. Like, take the precognition study from the start of this video. Three researchers attempted to replicate one of those experiments, and what did they find? Well, surprise, surprise, the hit rate they obtained was not significantly different from chance. When they tried to publish their findings in the same journal as the original paper, they were rejected. The reason? The journal refuses to publish replication studies. So if you're a scientist, the successful strategy is clear. Don't even attempt replication studies because few journals will publish them. And there is a very good chance that your results won't be statistically significant anyway. In which case, instead of being able to convince colleagues of the lack of reproducibility of an effect, you will be accused of just not doing it right. So a far better approach is to test novel and unexpected hypotheses and then p-hack your way to a statistically significant result. Now, I don't want to be too cynical about this, because over the past 10 years, things have started changing for the better. Many scientists acknowledge the problems I've outlined and are starting to take steps to correct them. There are more large-scale replication studies undertaken in the last 10 years. Plus, there's a site, Retraction Watch, dedicated to publicizing papers that have been withdrawn. There are online repositories for unpublished negative results, and there is a move towards submitting hypotheses and methods for peer review before conducting experiments, with the guarantee that research will be published regardless of results, so long as the procedure is followed. This eliminates publication bias, promotes higher-powered studies, and lessens the incentive for p-hacking. The thing I find most striking about the reproducibility crisis in science is not the prevalence of incorrect information in published scientific journals. After all, getting to the truth we know is hard, and mathematically, not everything that is published can be correct. What gets me is the thought that even trying our best to figure out what's true, using our most sophisticated and rigorous mathematical tools, peer review, and standards of practice, we still get it wrong so often. So how frequently do we delude ourselves when we're not using the scientific method? As flawed as our science may be, it is far and away more reliable than any other way of knowing that we have.
We'll pause for a quick break.
Attention grad students, share your research, find out what's going on in other disciplines, approach your work from a new angle. Check out Fire Talks, the interdisciplinary discussion forum sponsored by the Research Commons at Kerner Library. Visit bit.ly/firetalk for more information.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada, your p-hacking free radio broadcast. And we're back. We all know the media is manipulating our opinions, but how exactly does that work? Let's listen and see if we can find out how.
The media does not control your brain. Probably. I suppose it's possible that the media has controlled my brain such that I'm convinced that the media doesn't control brains. It's also possible, if not more likely, that I'm one of the people controlling your brain, so it would behoove me to lie about whether or not your brain is controlled by media. Or maybe your brain is controlled, but you like it that way, so whatever, water under the bridge, control away. If we can agree that the media doesn't literally control your brain, good. But still, we can't ignore the fact that the media, news, entertainment, even educational media, is able to handily deliver messages which impact the way we see the world, We learn our personal values from our parents, our friends, colleagues, and authority figures, but we also gain tons of insight about ourselves and the world from the arts, sciences, politics, entertainment, journalism. Much information about this stuff gets to us through the media. So the question is, as the media is bringing information and insight to us, and that information slash insight is having some kind of impact on our thoughts and actions, how exactly does that happen? How is it that media contains messages which we parse, judge, and sort into good or believable and bad or not believable? How does a message turn into an opinion or a behavior? Well, one explanation is the magic bullet theory, which is in reference to an actual bullet and not the magic bullet blender that you can buy on QVC.
Instant guacamole.
Sometimes called the hypodermic needle model as well, this media theory dates way back to the 1930s. It was popular during World War II when propaganda in both Germany and the United States was a big part of the media landscape.
Working together to produce an ever greater abundance of material and spiritual values for all. That is the secret of American prosperity.
At the time, it was thought that all audiences would respond basically uniformly to messages contained in media, that media messages were like bullets shot into the brains of spectators, or in the case of the hypodermic needle model, a serum injected into their bloodstream, and that they wouldn't be able to resist its effects. Basically, it was thought that media could directly influence public opinion. This was also an explanation as to how someone like Hitler, a literally evil overlord, could come to power. The relatively nascent technologies of radio and moving pictures could contain impossible-to-resist messages that would just implant into the minds of its audiences. Today, this sounds absurd, and actually remarkably like a conspiracy theory that the media can inject thoughts and meaning into its audiences who are unable to resist them.
Sweet.
I know they're not the same sunglasses, but just bear with me. You get the joke. But as media theorists, psychologists, and other experts tempered their assumptions about things like human nature and uniform effective response with, you know, research and stuff, two other theories came about. The first is called two-step flow. After thinking through the hypodermic needle model for a while, it became clear that it didn't account for the differing effectivenesses of media messages, or the varying not having it-ness of audience members, or the fact that people talk to one another. We don't all consume media in our individual media consumption cells and then stand dutifully silent in the break room discussing nothing of what we've watched, read, or thought. So where the magic bullet theory supposed direct influence of media on its audiences, two-step flow inserts a middleman. Between media and audience sits an authority figure, an opinion leader is what they're usually called, who are seen by others as well-informed, well-connected, and/or just good at what they do. They don't need to be famous or even popular, but often they are. Opinion leaders may be people on the TV, your coworker who seems to know a lot about politics, your aunt who works for the IRS, or your pal Janine, who's the office manager of a small business. They consume, digest, and refine the output of mass media and bring it to their own audience, who see them as more trustworthy than the media itself, making the two steps of two-step flow, one, media messages moving from source to opinion leader, and two, from opinion leader to the masses. Unlike the magic bullet, two-step flow admits that there's a social component to one's media diet. It isn't simply that the media does a thing and we accept the thing as a thing worth accepting. There's also a negotiation between various streams of media, their related messages, and social authority figures related to those media, as well as communities which form around it all. For some people, though, the agency provided by two-step flow doesn't go far enough. It still says media kind of influences people who then influence other people. It's the turtles all the way down of media influence. Two-step flow also has a complicated relationship to the internet, which amplifies opinion leaders, or influencers is I think what we're calling them these days, but it also empowers consumers, allowing them direct contact with media messages of their choosing. So it's how they do that choosing and how the choosing then affects their opinions that brings us to one final theory called uses and gratifications. Uses and gratifications is less a theory and more a way to think about why it is certain people gravitate towards certain media messages. The long and short of uses and gratifications answer to why people consume the media they do is because they wanna. In hoping to understand why people use media and what exactly they use it for, one proposed angle is that there are certain personal goals, views, or outcomes which certain media can help people reach, reinforce, or produce. Media may help us look smarter at work, may give us something to talk about with friends. Media may be cathartic, empowering, relaxing, or just simply interesting. Media has uses, and in that usage, we may feel gratified. That gratification then feeds back into how we choose more media and form our opinions around it. If we feel gratified, that media must have been right or good, and then we return to it. It's an effective tautology. We agree with media that makes us feel nice, and we feel nice about media that we agree with. So if the hypodermic media needle is like medicine that your body can't resist, and two-step flow is sort of like people you trust handing out the hypodermic needles, then uses and gratifications is like you standing in the cold, flu, and pain reliever aisle at the pharmacy deciding which brightly colored box is gonna unclog your schnoz. You gonna go with the one that's worked before, or the one that your pal Ashley recommended, or maybe just the one that looks really nice, or the cheapest. More so than media injecting us with messages or us going to opinion leaders to find out what it all means, uses and gratifications assumes that the audience will find and experience the media which is most useful to them for whatever reason that may be, which is the part that's easy to take issue with. Don't get me wrong, there are all kinds of uses for uses and gratifications. It gives most of the agency to people and not media, which is A+, nice work, good job. The problem is that it may give people so much agency, it sort of glosses over some of the things that are actually troubling about the media ecosystem and all of the powerful forces working within it. Threatening music and stuff. But seriously, like, to what degree can we really say that people's gratifications are fully self-determined? I'm not about to put my tinfoil hat back on and say that the media controls our brains and tells us what to like, but we also know how the mere exposure effect means the more we're exposed to something, especially a media something, the more we identify with it. This is one of the central principles of advertising, which both is and works for the media. I'm not uncritically defending the hypodermic needle, but media organizations do work very, very hard in lots of different and sometimes very tricky ways to get us to experience and accept certain messages even if we're not interested in them. Second, I think we can question the degree to which media consumption is clearly usage or gratification oriented. It may be hard slash impossible to say how and why someone enjoys a thing, or how exactly enjoyment or usefulness factor into choices determining one's media diet. You need only talk with a few friends about their favorite music, movies, books, or whatever to discover that most humans are not great at knowing why we like stuff. We like stuff because certain other people like it, because certain other people don't like it, because we've been told to, because we feel we have to, and a million other reasons. And rarely do we sit down and think, ah, yes, I find this media message pleasurable and I will allow it to dictate my opinions because the in-group I wish to belong to believes that, nope, it doesn't work that way. In the end, to the degree that opinions and beliefs are influenced by the media we consume, how that works may be a weighted combination of these three ideas, operating at varying levels of complexity and effectiveness. Just hopefully not perfect effectiveness. To return to our metaphor, standing in the grocery store aisle looking at boxes doesn't describe all of medicine, only one part, and it doesn't cancel the other parts out. They all coexist. Just as, if not more helpful, maybe to use these theories to talk about how we want media to interact with public opinion. Being able to recognize when, how, and that certain opinions and beliefs are carried, reinforced, and often encouraged by particular media sources. We're able to ask if the fact and method of such a thing is something that we're comfortable with. Are any of your preferences, for lack of a better word, injected? Why does certain media gratify you the way that it does? And why do you take what Janine says so seriously?
Ghostbusters, what do you want?
As a member of the manipulated media, I'm going to tell you to take a break now, as we'll return in a moment.
depressed lately? UBC Yoga Club is here to offer you a peace of mind. Come out to any of our 17 weekly classes running 7 days a week, ranging from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. We have a class to accommodate your needs and abilities. Check us out at ubcyogaclub.com.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101 FM Radio. Your one media source teaching you how to think and not telling you what to think. And we're back. One thing that's hard for some people to accept is that we'll never know all the answers. For every new answer, it just leads to more new questions. And there are some questions that may just be beyond human understanding. Let's listen into a TED Talk about questions no one knows the answer to.
On a typical day at school, endless hours are spent learning the answers to questions. But right now, we'll do the opposite. We're going to focus on questions where you can't learn the answers because they're unknown. I used to puzzle about a lot of things as a boy. For example, what would it feel like to be a dog? Do fish feel pain? Well, how about insects? Was the Big Bang just an accident? I mean, is there a God? And if so, how are we so sure that it's a he and not a she? Why do so many innocent people and animals suffer terrible things? Is there really a plan for my life? Is the future yet to be written? Or is it already written? We just can't see it. But then, do I have free will? Who am I anyway? Am I just a biological machine? But then, why am I conscious? What is consciousness? Will robots become conscious one day? I mean, I kind of assumed that someday I would be told the answers to all these questions. Someone must know, right? Guess what? No one knows. Most of those questions puzzle me more now than ever, but diving into them is exciting because it takes you to the edge of knowledge and you never know what you'll find there. So, two questions that no one on earth knows the answer to. Sometimes when I'm on a long plane flight, I gaze out at all those mountains and deserts and try to get my head around how vast our Earth is. And then I remember there's an object we see every day that would literally fit 1 million Earths inside it. The sun seems impossibly big, but in the great scheme of things, it's a pinprick, one of about 400 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, which you can see on a clear night as a pale white mist stretched across the sky. And it gets worse, there are maybe 100 billion galaxies detectable by our telescopes. So if each star was the size of a single grain of sand, just the Milky Way has enough stars to fill a 30-foot by 30-foot stretch of beach, 3 feet deep with sand. And the entire Earth doesn't have enough beaches to represent the stars in the overall universe. Such a beach would continue for literally hundreds of millions of miles. Holy Stephen Hawking, that is a lot of stars. But he and other physicists now believe in a reality that is unimaginably bigger still. I mean, first of all, the 100 billion galaxies within range of our telescopes are probably a minuscule fraction of the total. Space itself is expanding at an accelerating pace. The vast majority of the galaxies are separating from us so fast that light from them may never reach us. Still, our physical reality here on Earth is intimately connected to those distant invisible galaxies. We could think of them as part of our universe. They make up a single giant edifice, obeying the same physical laws and all made from the same types of atoms, electrons, protons, quarks, neutrinos that make up you and me. However, recent theories in physics, including one called string theory, are now telling us there could be countless other universes built on different types of particles with different properties obeying different laws. Most of these universes could ever support life and might flash in and out of existence in a nanosecond. But nonetheless, combined, they make up a vast multiverse of possible universes in up to 11 dimensions, featuring wonders beyond our wildest imagination. And the leading version of string theory predicts a multiverse made up of 10 to the 500 universes. It's a 1 followed by 500 zeros. number so vast that if every atom in our observable universe had its own universe, and all of the atoms in all those universes each had their own universe, and you repeated that for two more cycles, you'd still be at a tiny fraction of the total, namely 1,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, compared to another number, infinity. Some physicists think the space-time continuum is literally infinite and that it contains an infinite number of so-called pocket universes with varying properties. How's your brain doing? Quantum theory adds a whole new wrinkle. I mean, the theory's been proven true beyond all doubt, but interpreting it is baffling, and some physicists think you can only unbaffle it if you imagine that huge numbers of parallel universes are being spawned every moment. And many of these universes would actually be very like the world we're in, would include multiple copies of you. In one such universe, you graduate with honors and marry the person of your dreams. In another, not so much. Well, there are still some scientists who would say hogwash. The only meaningful answer to the question of how many universes there are is one. Only one universe. And a few philosophers and mystics might argue that even our own universe is an illusion. So as you can see, right now, there is no agreement on this question, not even close. All we know is the answer is somewhere between zero and infinity. Well, I guess we know one other thing. This is a pretty cool time to be studying physics. We just might be undergoing the biggest paradigm shift in knowledge that humanity has ever seen. Somewhere out there in that vast universe, there must surely be countless other planets teeming with life. But why don't we see any evidence of it? Well, this is the famous question asked by Enrico Fermi in 1950. Where is everybody? Conspiracy theorists claim that UFOs are visiting all the time and the reports are just being covered up. But honestly, they aren't very convincing. But that leaves a real riddle. In the past year, the Kepler Space Observatory has found hundreds of planets just around nearby stars. And if you extrapolate that data, it looks like there could be half a trillion planets just in our own galaxy. If only one in 10,000 has conditions that might support a form of life, that's still 50 million possible life-harboring planets right here in the Milky Way. So here's the riddle. Our Earth didn't form until about 9 billion years after the Big Bang. Countless other planets in our galaxy should have formed earlier and given life a chance to get underway billions, or certainly many millions of years earlier than happened on Earth. If just a few of them had spawned intelligent life and started creating technologies, those technologies would have had millions of years to grow in complexity and power. On Earth, we've seen how dramatically technology can accelerate in just 100 years. In millions of years, an intelligent alien civilization could easily have spread out across the galaxy, perhaps creating giant energy-harvesting artifacts, or fleets of colonizing spaceships, or glorious works of art that fill the night sky. At the very least, you'd think they'd be revealing their presence, deliberately or otherwise, through electromagnetic signals of one kind or another. And yet we see no convincing evidence of any of it. Why? Well, there are numerous possible answers, some of them quite dark. Maybe a single superintelligent civilization has indeed taken over the galaxy and has imposed strict radio silence because it's paranoid of any potential competitors. It's just sitting there ready to obliterate anything that becomes a threat. Or maybe they're not that intelligent. Or perhaps the evolution of an intelligence capable of creating sophisticated technology is far rarer than we've assumed. After all, it's only happened once on Earth in 4 billion years. Maybe even that was incredibly lucky. Maybe we are the first such civilization in our galaxy. Or perhaps civilization carries with it the seeds of its own destruction through the inability to control the technologies it creates. But there are numerous more hopeful answers. I mean, for a start, we're not looking that hard, and we're spending a pitiful amount of money on it. Only a tiny fraction of the stars in our galaxy have really been looked at closely for signs of interesting signals. And perhaps we're not looking the right way. Maybe as civilizations develop, they quickly discover communication technologies far more sophisticated and useful than electromagnetic waves. Maybe all the action takes place inside the mysterious, recently discovered dark matter or dark energy that appear to account for most of the universe's mass. Or maybe we're looking at the wrong scale. Perhaps intelligent civilizations come to realize that life is ultimately just complex patterns of information interacting with each other in a beautiful way, and that that can happen more efficiently at a small scale. So just as on Earth, clunky stereo systems have shrunk to beautiful tiny iPods, maybe intelligent life itself, in order to reduce its footprint on the environment, has turned itself microscopic, so the solar system might be teeming with aliens and we're just not noticing them. Maybe the very ideas in our heads are a form of alien life. Well, okay, that's a crazy thought. The aliens made me say it. But it is cool that ideas do seem to have a life all of their own, and that they outlive their creators. Maybe biological life is just a passing phase. Well, within the next 15 years, we could start seeing real spectroscopic information from promising nearby planets that will reveal just how life-friendly they might be. And meanwhile, SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, is now releasing its data to the public so that millions of citizen scientists, maybe including you, can bring the power of the crowd to join the search. And here on Earth, amazing experiments are being done to try to create life from scratch, life that might be very different from the DNA forms we know. All of this will help us understand whether the universe is teeming with life or whether indeed it's just us. Either answer, in its own way, is awe-inspiring. Because even if we are alone, the fact that we think and dream and ask these questions might yet turn out to be one of the most important facts about the universe. And I have one more piece of good news for you. The quest for knowledge and understanding never gets dull. It doesn't. It's actually the opposite. The more you know, the more amazing the world seems. And it's the crazy possibilities, the unanswered questions that pull us forward. So, stay curious.
And lastly, we'll end with a song from Symphony of Science. It's a tribute to Muhammad Ali entitled Champion of the World. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, from Louisville, Kentucky, wearing black tie, Mr. Cassius Marcellus Clay, his classic poem, I Am the Greatest.
This kid's got a left. This kid's got a right. If he hits you once, you're asleep for the night. This kid fights great. He's got speed and endurance. But if you sign to fight him, increase your insurance.
Word.
The man's in trouble. I'm gonna show you. I know you got a grip, but the man's in trouble. I'm gonna show you how great I am. I'm gonna show you. I'm gonna show you. I'm gonna show you how great I am. How great I am.
This brash young boxer is something to see. And the heavyweight championship is his destiny.
Listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sun.